Let's open our Bibles together to 2 Samuel chapter 1. Some people just simply do the unexpected. Maybe you are one of those people. There are folks that simply won't stay in the expectations that seem to be put on us in our society. Sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes it's not a good thing, but we're going to talk about the good part this morning. People who break the averages do things that others look on and say, I wish I'd have thought of that. I wish I'd have done that. That was a good thing to do. Back in 1967, there was a baseball game going on at Connie Mack Field in Philadelphia, and the Phillies and the Mets were playing, and a thunder shower came and drenched the stadium, just began to pour, as they can in the Midwest. And everybody ran for cover, all of the players. I mean, it just began to turn everything to mud, and they all ran for cover. Except one young lady ran out of the stands, or the dugout around the edges. I forget where she was, but she ran out and she pulled the flag, the American flag, down. And she wrapped it up and she stuck it under her coat, and she was drenched. And she ran back and jumped in one of the dugouts. And everybody gave her a standing ovation, the players and the people in the crowds. It was a moment when everybody said, hey, I wish I had a thought to do that. What makes a person do something no one else does? What's going on in a person who says, I'm going to do something different? Now, I don't think she said to herself, how can I get attention for me? How can I make other people give me a standing ovation in this? Oh, I know what I'll do. I'll go rescue the flag during a thunder shower. No, she didn't plan this at all. This is the kind of decision that happens because inside it was the way she was. It was simply the way she already was, and what she was doing was completely natural to her, but it was very different than anybody else. And people like that can be such a refreshment to us. Have you ever had that happen where you think you watch someone or you hear someone say something and you go, man, I should have been thinking that. I should have been saying that. I should have been doing that. These are curve breakers. These are people who don't stay in the averages. They think differently than others do. King David is a person like this. Have you noticed? Have you seen so many contrasts in his life? I mean, he's at the age of 30 as we look into 2 Samuel chapter 1. And David has gone through a whole lot up to this point. But I want to just point out for a moment that he is a curve breaker. He's a man who thinks differently than others do. And he's a man of tremendous contrast. I hope, and I've said it a lot of times, I want to keep saying it, I hope we get him off of the flannel board, out of the Christian comic book, and into real life. This was a man in Technicolor. This was a three-dimensional man for all of his problems and all of his difficulties. He's a man who thought differently. He's a man who thought the way God thought on a lot of things, not everything. But he was a man willing to do what was different. Think of the contrasts in his life. In fact, let's call them paradoxes. A paradox is something that looks like it ought not to go together. But when you get closer, you find out it does go together. I just jotted down a few things about David that make him stand out. These are contrasts in his life, paradoxes. He was a shepherd boy on an errand who ended up killing a giant. Now, who could have told that that would happen as he heads out down toward the valley on an errand from his dad that he's going to kill Goliath, a shepherd boy who kills a giant. He's a giant killer who plays the harp. Huh? A giant killer who plays the harp. What a contrast. He's a harpist who becomes a general, a warrior, a general. He's a general who becomes a fugitive. He's a fugitive who writes worship songs. Amazing. He's a worshiper who becomes a Philistine mercenary. Interesting. He's a mercenary who inherits a kingdom. What a different man. What a really technicolor man. What an awesome guy. And he is a curve breaker at every point. Almost at the moment you think you have David figured out, he says something or does something radically different. Sometimes it's a mistake, but you know, not as often as he makes a good decision. And when he makes a good decision, as we're going to see some this morning in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel, they are decisions made because he thinks differently. He thinks with a heart for God. And it sets him apart from the people around him. I want to see some of those as we look into this. Here's my outline, okay? There's a surprising circumstance in which he hears the news that he will be king. And then he makes a very surprising decision about the man who brings him the news. And then he expresses a very surprising emotion at the last part of the chapter. At every point along the line, it is surprise, surprise, surprise. David is a curve breaker. He makes decisions we wouldn't expect, and I'm going to point that out. It's what I'm going to camp on. He's different. And it starts with a different circumstance. Look at verse 1. This is a surprise contrast in his circumstances. Verse 1, 2 Samuel chapter 1. It came about after the death of Saul that David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David remained 2 days in Ziklag. Now you say to yourself, well, is there any spiritual application in this verse? Well, there is, actually. Think back to what happened. You guys were with us last week, or most of you were. Remember that while Saul was in the Battle of Gilboa up in the north, David was fighting for his life and the life of his family against the Amalekites down in Ziklag, which was his city. For the past 16 months, David has been a Philistine mercenary, essentially, cheating the Philistines, lying to them, pretending to work for them as a soldier, when in reality he was attacking the enemies of Israel, kind of playing a very dangerous double agent kind of a game for the last 16 months. He's got 600 fierce warriors, and we're going to learn more about those men next week. They're fascinating men. 600 of them and their families to take care of. And Ziklag, the city in which they had all lived, had been sacked while they were gone, sacked by the Amalekites. He comes back to his city, Ziklag. It's in ashes. It's just burning rubble. His family has been kidnapped. He's at the lowest point in his life. We looked at it last time. He's at the lowest point in his life to that point. And the Lord says, go get the Amalekites and get your family back. So he leads his 600 guys out there. They do this forced march, this incredibly exhausting thing. They defeat the Amalekites. They come back and they've got the families and everybody's happy, but they have no city. Now you're David. You're 30 years old. You've been running for your life from Saul for the last 3 to 5 years. It's true you have your family there. It's true, or part of your family. Michael, his first wife, is back still in the city of Jerusalem. But he has, his other wives are there. His family is there. There are people around. But he comes back, and have you ever been in have you ever been in what was left of a building after it burned? The smell is strong, and it stays for a long time. It gets on your clothes. It gets in your hair. That's what David is in Ziklag in verse 1 of 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1. David is in Ziklag in the ashes, and it's true he's rescued his family, but he has no place to go. He's probably thinking, what am I going to do now? He doesn't know yet that Saul is dead. He doesn't know yet that he will now become king, at least in the southern part of Israel. He has no idea. He's thinking, I can't go back to Israel because I escaped from Israel because Saul's trying to kill me. And now my city among the Philistines has been burned to the ground. I have 600 families to care for. Lord, what now? It is into this circumstance that a runner comes and gives David news that his whole life has changed. And I just want to point something out. You never know when God's going to change the direction of your life. You never know when God's going to change the direction of your life. You may be saying, my life is ashes. It is a pile of ashes right now. It's been burned to the ground. But who's to say that today or tonight or tomorrow, God will not bring something to you that will alter your direction? It doesn't happen every day, but you never know when it will. And it pays to be prepared. And David, amazingly, was prepared. He was always expecting the unexpected, it seems. It was into this circumstance, this surprising circumstance, that a runner comes. And this brings us now to the strange, surprising decision he makes about this runner. Let's read the story. Verse 2, it happened on the third day that, behold, a man came out from the camp of Saul with his clothes torn and dust on his head, which were signs of grief. And it came about that when he came to David, he fell to the ground and laid himself out, prostrated himself out before David in honor. And David said to him, from where do you come? And he said to him, I've escaped from the camp of Israel. You can see him. This man comes. He's all kind of looks terrible, lays down in front of David. David's men are standing around. David looks at him. David is dressed in his normal garb, probably got his sword on and everything. And these are warriors. The city is completely destroyed. And here comes this, turns out to be an Amalekite warrior, and lays down in front of him. David says, "What's going on? Where are you from?" "I've escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said, "How did things go? Tell me." David is extremely interested in the Battle of Gilboa. Remember, he almost was in it on the wrong side. You remember that? He was almost fighting on the side of the Philistines, and providentially, God arranged for him not to be there. And he was down rescuing his own family when Gilboa was being fought. How did it go? David is always concerned for Israel. You know, you'd think he'd be more concerned just for himself, but he's always concerned for Israel. It's his passion almost, second to God, but it's his passion to watch out for the people of Israel. It's part of being the king of Israel, really, even before he was king. How did it go? What happened? Tell me. "Well, the people have fled from the battle, and many of the people have fallen slain and are dead, and Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead." And David had always hoped that Jonathan would be able to serve with him, because Jonathan wanted that too. They had talked about it. And when David heard those words, "Saul and Jonathan are dead in the battle," David could picture in his mind, you know, the battle scene. He'd been in so many battle scenes, you know, he'd seen so much death, and he thought, oh, I mean, just crushed him. And you can tell by the poem that he writes at the end of the chapter. He hears these words, it crushes onto him at this point. And David says, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who had told him said, "Well, by chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa. And behold, Saul was leaning on his spear." Now, I want you guys to compare this with what you know from last week about how Saul died. If you were here last week, remember the study and what happened. And now this Malachite comes and says, "Well, I happened to be there on Mount Gilboa. And Saul was leaning on his spear, and the chariots and the horsemen were pursuing him closely. They were pressing in. They were not far from him. And he looked behind him, and he saw me, and he called out to me, and he said, and I said, 'Here I am.' And he answered me. He says, 'Who are you?' I said, 'Well, I'm an Amalekite.' And he said, 'Stand beside me and kill me, because agony has seized me, and my life still lingers in me.'" In other words, Saul, we know from the other chapter, had been wounded by the archers. And so, according to this Amalekite, he's saying, "Well, I happened to be there, and Saul looked at me, and Saul wanted me to kill him." Verse 10, "So I stood beside him and killed him, because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm, and I've brought them to you." And he probably fumbled in the bag and pulled out the crown that would belong to Saul. And David recognized it instantly. And the armband, which was not a bracelet like a woman wears, it was worn up on the bicep. A bronze bracelet or some sort of gold bracelet or something up on the bicep. It was a sign of Saul's regal position. And this was proof, of course, that the Amalekite at least was telling the truth about one thing, and that is that Saul was dead, because he would never have had those things if Saul had not been dead. And when, as soon as he produced these things, fumbled them out, the men around David and David himself would have just, you know, it somehow you involuntarily just exhale when you're, it's like, oh, no. And that's the feeling. David took hold of his clothes and he tore them, and so also did the men who were with him. And they mourned and they wept and they fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the people of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. David might have been thinking, man, if I had been there, this might not have happened. But it wasn't God's plan that David be there. God's plan was to defeat Saul, and we know that. We've read other parts of the story that David didn't know, right? But David would have been thinking at this time, if I'd have been there among the Philistines, me and my 600 guys, we could have killed 1,000 or 2,000 Philistines in this thing. We could have turned the tide. We could have saved Israel. He's probably thinking all that stuff. And he's torn his clothes, and he's fasted until evening, and defeat has come to the people of God, and he's grieved by this. And David said to the young man who told him, "Where are you from?" Now, this doesn't mean, where did you come from today? It means, where do you live? What's your nationality? He said, "Well, I'm the son of an alien. I'm an Amalekite." And David said, "How is it that you're not afraid to stretch out your hand and destroy the Lord's anointed?" Remember, David himself would not kill Saul when he had it in his power. And David called one of the young men and said, go execute him. Cut him down is the technical term. But it was an execution. When it says cut him down, that means that's an execution. So he did it. He struck him and he died. And David said to him, your blood is on your own head. Your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. Now, I tell you, my friends, this bothers me. First time I read it years and years, many, many years ago, I remember thinking to myself, well, it's no wonder this story's not made it to the flannel graph in the Sunday school. You know, we're very choosy about the stuff, the stories we tell. Here's this guy with news, supposedly good news for David, and David executes him. Doesn't that bother anybody? I mean, by our standard, it should, or at least at first. It's a paradox. Now, remember I said we're talking about surprising things and decisions people make that are not the norm, that are not what we would expect. And David makes a decision here to execute a man that thinks he's bringing good news to him, thinks he's doing David a favor, and David executes him. And my initial response was, David, don't you think that's a little harsh? Don't you think that's going a little far? But think this through. I want to answer two questions. Number one, was the Amalekite telling the truth? And I won't belabor this, but remember, if you remember from last week, this is not how Saul died according to 1 Samuel, the last chapter. According to 1 Samuel, the last chapter, Saul didn't fall on his spear, he fell on his sword, and he did it himself. And I can't believe a guy who was a professional soldier and whose business it was to make sure that people died by the sword would mess up if doing it to himself. I just can't believe that. But there would be good reason for an Amalekite who happened to be there to pick up the crown and take the arm bracelet and say to himself, I can make myself a real position in life. Because I know David will be the next king. I'll take these things down to him, and I'll take credit for killing Saul, because I know he's David's enemy. And it was a time-honored way in those days to bring yourself into the favor of the king if you killed one of his enemies. I believe the Amalekite's lying. Now, commentators are split on the subject. Some believe he was, and some believe he wasn't. But when you compare the stories, I am among those who believe that this Amalekite lied to David. Now, David didn't know that he lied. David didn't know the facts that we know. He hadn't read the story, right? He was in it. Nevertheless, by the man's own admission, he had killed the Lord's anointed, something David refused to do. And so David executed him, which probably was a shock not only to the Amalekite, who thought he was doing David a favor and was going to become a really powerful guy in the new kingdom. He probably was already decorating his office mentally, thinking to himself, man, I'm going to be something special. Not only a surprise to the Amalekite, but probably a surprise to David's men around him, unless they knew David very, very well. Some of them, like Asahel, who, remember Asahel had tried to kill Saul? He said, turn away, David, I'll just stick him to the ground. Remember that? Remember that? I'll just skewer him, and he won't wiggle. Remember that? These guys would do that. Asahel's probably thinking to himself, when the Amalekites talk and saying, I killed Saul, Asahel knew David well enough, he might not have been surprised at this decision. He might have been thinking, well, you dumb Amalekite, you shouldn't have done that. I'll tell you, let me tell you something, son. This is a dumb decision. You do not do this. But the others might have been surprised. Was the Amalekite lying? First question, probably. Second question, why did David execute him? Why did David execute him? If you know David really well, you might guess. If you only know him surface, you might look at this and say, this is ridiculous. Why would he do such a thing? But if you know David real well, you know that as a king working for God, he had to make this decision. Matter of fact, the more you think about it, the more you realize he had no choice. He had to execute this guy. Why? Why is that the case? Well, three reasons. Number one, he wanted to make it clear that he would not allow murder to go unpunished in his kingdom. He was a king. He did not have the luxury of saying, well, I'm just not going to pay attention to this. Murder is murder even when someone asks you to do it to them. Dr. Kevorkian, are you listening? I am dead serious about this. Oh, pardon the pun. Just thought of that. This is serious business in our culture. You know, what we're thinking is that human life isn't worth very much these days if it's no fun. As soon as life stops being fun, Well, then let's just unload it. And as soon as, maybe the next step, as soon as someone else stops being convenient, let's unload them. Because human life in our culture is not valued. I want you to notice that David executed a man for killing, supposedly, I mean, if you believe the story, for killing someone at their own request who was going to die eventually anyway, but David still executed him. Why? Because murder is murder even if someone asks you to do it. And jot down Genesis 9, verse 6. Genesis 9, 6 says, If you shed man's blood, by man shall your blood be shed, meaning capital punishment. Now, some people debate that in the New Testament and say, well, capital punishment ought not to be based on some things in the New Testament. But I'm not even going to deal with that. There was no question of it in the Old Testament. None. And I personally believe in capital punishment, if you want to know my opinion, even based on New Testament passages. But in David's mind, he had to execute this guy because murder is murder even when somebody asks you to do it. And we need to understand, brothers and sisters, that God says, I will require your blood if you murder somebody, not because it will deter crime, but because humans are created in my image and I won't allow you to kill them for your own reasons. Execution, judicial execution, is another issue, and it's another Hebrew word, by the way. And let me also make one other point. The removal of extraordinary life-saving measures. Now, some of you are already thinking ahead of me, aren't you? The removal of extraordinary life-saving measures is not in view here. Because that is not killing somebody. That is simply deciding that there's nothing more that can be done to save them. That's a different decision. That's not what's in view here. What we have here is a person who wants to die and wants someone else to do it to them. And David says, in essence, by his actions, he makes it clear, that's murder, and I'm the king of Israel, and I cannot let that go. I cannot let it go. Now, later in his life, he makes a mistake by not dealing with a murder. And we'll talk about that when we get to it. But at this point, he makes a good decision that is unusual. But I told you there were three reasons he executed this guy. One had to do with just the issue of murder. The next one had to do with the fact of being the king. He did not want to reward murder as a way of currying favor with him, which was common among the ancient kings. And everyone's standing around thinking, what's he going to do with this Amalekite? When he executed that Amalekite, you can believe very deeply that everybody learned a lesson. You don't get ahead with David by simply murdering other people. You can't get anywhere in this kingdom by violating God's law about this. David cares about God's law, and we're going to do what pleases David, see? And we're going to be careful we do that. And so David set a very important pattern here. He did not want, as a king, to reward murder as a way of currying favor. He had to kill this Amalekite. Third, he wouldn't sanction murder as a means of changing kings, which became a very common thing in the ancient world. He wanted to make it clear, you don't change kings by killing the old one. There's a very good personal reason for this one, too, you know, in addition to God's law. It's a bad precedent to set, you know, if you're going to be the king. You're going to wear this crown. You want to be careful that you haven't set a precedent of assassination in order to acquire it, because the next guy's going to think, well, David did it. He assassinated somebody, or he rewarded the guy that assassinated him. You follow what I'm saying? Now, look at it a little more carefully. Looking at it from David's perspective, as a godly man, thinking about the law of God, thinking about the issue of murder, thinking about being a real leader, he had to make this decision. Even though when we look at it, we think maybe that was too harsh, but he made the decision anyway. He's a surprising man, and he thinks differently, and he's a curve breaker, but he was thinking on a very deep level here. Now that brings us to the next thing that is surprising. David chanted with this lament over Saul and Jonathan, his son, and he told the people to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. He calls it the song of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jashar. Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. Oh, how the mighty have fallen. Have you ever heard that phrase? Oh, how the mighty have fallen. Did you know that it came out of one of David's poems, the one he wrote for Saul and for Jonathan when they died? He wrote this piece of music. Oh, how the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath, Philistine city. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. another Philistine city. Don't let the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. O mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, and the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. He's saying these men died at their post. And he's really exalting Saul and Jonathan because they died at their post doing exactly what God called them to do, defend Israel. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life, and in their death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. Saul was a good king in that respect. He protected Israel. He really did. And he saw to it that the people were cared for militarily. In his walk with God, he was terrible, which is why he ultimately lost. But as a king, he did die at his post, and he was honorable. And David chooses that to write about at this moment. It's an interesting thing. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of battle. Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You've been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. Oh, how the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. People wonder about that phrase, David speaking of the love of Jonathan, and more wonderful to him than the love of women. In those days, it was not common for men and women, even married men and women, to be best friends. We sort of assume that that is an ideal if you can do it. In those days, it was not so. And the men had comrades that they fought alongside. There was such a bonding in them that they would say something like this. This is an extremely high tribute that David would say, that my friendship with you was deeper and more significant than my relationships even with my wives. There's no sexual overtone whatsoever, as some people have speculated. That's the most ridiculous thing anybody ever heard. This has to do with the bonding that occurred between David and Jonathan because they had fought side by side, risked their lives together, and they were really both men who loved God. They were, that the friendship they had was so deep and powerful. David is completely distraught by the loss of Jonathan. And so he uses this expression. Now, this is one of the most beautiful poems in the whole Bible. In fact, in all of ancient literature, in English, it's beautiful. In Hebrew, it's even more beautiful. It is an absolute gem of lament as David grieves over Saul and Jonathan. Remember, we're talking about unusual responses. Does anybody see this as an unusual response? What would the natural thing to do be here? To rejoice. Saul is dead. Nee, 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 you know? Saul is dead. I'm so happy. Oh, but I'm going to act sad. That's not it. David really is grieved by this thing. And that tells us something very deep and powerful about David. He had either forgiven Saul. When you talk about a different way of thinking. He had either forgiven Saul or he had never viewed Saul as a personal enemy in the first place, which is an amazing thing. Either of those are the kind of thinking that a person does who doesn't go along with the crowd, who says, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to do something that doesn't come naturally. I'm going to do something rare. See, in both of these circumstances, David does something different. Back up to the Amalekite story for just a moment. What would the natural thing to do be there? Would be to say, I'll reward the Amalekite because he's been loyal to me. But he doesn't do the natural thing. What's the natural thing to do with Saul? I'll rejoice because Saul is dead. Look at what I have now. I'm relieved of all of this pressure of having to run away from my life. I'm relieved. Oh, what a great thing. I'm vindicated. It turns out I was right and he was wrong. Neener, neener, you know. And I get to be king. I'm promoted. I'm so happy. I'm promoted. Get to be king of the country. And David doesn't express any of those things. A very different response. You know, I got to tell you guys, I would have responded differently in myself. I admit that. And I think that's why in reading these things, I thought, this is weird. At first, my first reading of it, I thought, this is weird. But David was thinking better than I would have thought. I think he was thinking better than many of us would have thought. Back up for just a moment and evaluate these two things. The natural thing to do for the Amalekite was to reward him for showing loyalty. Instead, David executes him because God's law really required it. So let me ask you a question. Is personal loyalty better than actual integrity? Write that down. Is personal loyalty better than actual integrity? Is it better to be a loyal friend, or is it better to tell the truth, even if it hurts? Is personal loyalty more valuable than actual integrity? See, to David, he would not sacrifice integrity for loyalty. He wanted loyalty. He was a very loyal friend, but not if it meant turning away from God. Not if it meant doing something, rewarding a guy who had murdered Saul. You see? You know, brothers and sisters, you want to think differently in this world? Pursue loyalty with your friends by all means. It's one of the main ingredients, especially among men, personal loyalty. But not at the expense of real integrity. That's how David thought differently. David said to himself, I will be loyal to God first, and anyone who's a loyal friend of mine will share that loyalty to God. And I won't sugarcoat it if someone, a friend of mine, is doing what's wrong. I may be gentle with them, I may be whatever, but I'm gonna live by what God has told me. That was a real difference in David, wasn't it? Move on to the question of the grieving for Saul. The natural thing to do was to rejoice because it was a personal advantage. But let me ask you this, and here's the question for this. Write it down. Is personal advantage more important than Christian ethics? Is personal advantage more important than Christian ethics? A person who says, I won't do that because it's unethical, even though it might be legal and even though I might make a lot of money at it, but it's unethical. Why won't I do it? Because I belong to God. That's a person who thinks differently. David says, I'm not going to rejoice at the death of Saul, even though it's a great advantage to me on paper in every way. But he writes a lament. He writes a lament. That is a different way of thinking. Is personal advantage more important than spiritual ethics, real Christian ethics? A person who knows that real advantage is found only in Christian ethics and really obeying God, that's where the real advantage is, that person will think differently on almost every level, in business, in friendship, in leisure, the way they use leisure time, all kinds of ways. You see how different it is? David was a curve breaker. And again, I've told you before, I don't believe David was a softy. He was not particularly merciful. I don't think you can prove that from his life. But one thing absolutely had a grip on his heart, and that was he wanted to do what God wanted. That's what he wanted to do. And he cared about thinking like God more than anything else. That's what made him so different. Surprising things, huh? A man of contrast, a man who's a curve breaker, a man that just when you think you got a grip on who he is, he changes or makes a different decision than you'd expect. Let me close with two thoughts. First is this, contrast is where the witness is. The witness for Jesus in our world is found in the contrast, the difference between us and the world around us, the way we deal with life, how we deal with mistreatment, how we deal with legal things, how we deal with money, how we deal with love, how we deal with friendships. And if you think that's a simple thing, my friend, you just haven't had to make any heavy decisions recently. It's not easy to make these kinds of heavy decisions. But it is the difference between you and the world that sets you apart, makes you think like Jesus, and demonstrates the glory of God. That's why there's no real Clairol Christians. Remember the old Clairol ad, you know, only the hairdresser knows for sure. And the Clairol Christian isn't a witness, because they blend in so much with the world that they don't stand out on any level. David was different. And it is that contrast that produces the witness for Jesus Christ. David was wiser at the age of 30 than Saul was at the age of 60, and that was their respective differences in age at the time this happened. David was making wise decisions at the age of 30, these heavy-duty decisions that set him apart. Saul was making terribly unwise decisions talking to the witch at Endor, and he was 60. David was different. You know, it's never too late to start being different this way. Here's the second thing. The first was, the contrast is where the witness is. Secondly, character shows at the crossroads. Character really shows at the crossroads. When the pressure's on and you got to make the decision and everything's coming down, that's where your character is being tested, and that's where it really shows. And you want to know something? We don't know what our own character looks like. We could write our own bio, our own clippings, and say, well, I'm this way, and I'm this way, and I'm this way. But when the pressure's on, that's when it really shows. When the temptation is high, when Ziklag is in ashes, and the expectation is to reward the Amalekite, or when your enemy is before you and the expectation is to wipe them out, or to rejoice over their death, you know, it's those crossroad decisions that really show what kind of character you have. And we don't know what our character is until some of those crossroads occur. Maybe you're at a crossroads right now, and you're thinking, well, I could go this way, I could go that way. Well, I don't know. Don't ask me. But I can tell you this. When you ask that question and you look at your various options, realize your character is being tested. And the decision you make needs to be made in light of who God is and what He's doing and how different you want to be than the world is. Then you make your decision in the grace of God and by the power of the Spirit. But I tell you, that is a challenge. It's at the crossroads of life that the real character shows. And crossroads don't come all the time. They come every once in a while, just a few times during a life. But they can come up on you pretty quick when you don't expect them. Are you a curve breaker? Am I? I hope I am. You know, I hope I am. But I don't know until something comes up whether or not I'm the man I want to be. Let's bow our heads, close our eyes, and ask ourselves these kinds of questions. It's an amazing chapter filled with surprises, but they make us ask ourselves, who are we really deep down inside? How different are we? And what's the contrast in our lives between the way we are and the way the world is around us? Being different doesn't mean just being weird. It doesn't mean just doing things differently for the sake of difference. It means thinking like the Lord at every level and letting the differences come out naturally, just like that young girl who ran across the field and took the flag down. It was in her heart to do that naturally. No one told her to do it. She didn't practice it ahead of time. That's the way we want to live our Christian life, doing something that is right, not because we've practiced it so much, but because it just comes from the inside out. So open your heart to the Lord right now, and I will too. And we'll ask Him to change us and make us that way on the inside. Make us think more deeply, more profoundly, more distinctly as Christians. Father, we open our hearts to You as believers and ask that You would indeed teach us the areas in which we have been thinking like the world, really, or like the old ways in our own lives, instead of like You. And make it natural for us, Father, to follow You. Natural to think Your thoughts, even as we see David thinking them here, making very different decisions. Each of us, Father, faces some very distinct challenges even today, and we want to do what You would have us do. So by Your Holy Spirit, fill us and mold us and change us. Make us people like this. In Jesus' name, amen.